Recording live from the Hoban Law Group here in Denver, Colorado, I'm your host, Eric Singular. We're sitting alongside president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban. Today, we are talking about intrepid pathways across the global cannabis industry. And we have two incredible globetrotters, cannabis globetrotters, if you will. We have president and founder of the Hoban Law Group, Bob Hoban, and we have CEO of I Comply Inc., Mark's Law. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me this evening.
Thanks for having us, Eric.
Where do we begin? The numerous countries that you guys have gotten to travel to, all in the name of trying to advance this thing, this idea of a global cannabis industry, has opened all kinds of doors for you guys at a personal level. It opens all kinds of doors for business. It opens all kinds of doors to experience cultures that you may not have gotten to experience otherwise. And Bob, I know this is something we've talked about on the Hoban Minute, but when you look at all of the different paths that you've walked, all of the different places you've gotten to explore because of this plant, this amazing cannabis plant, what is there to say, man? Where do we begin?
Where do we begin is exactly right. You know, that's one of the downsides. One of the downsides that you lament as it relates to the COVID scenario, right? All of a sudden, we're relegated to limited travel or living in our home state and not leaving, which, by the way, there's a great beauty in that. And I think a lot of us have found that beauty of just being complacent, sitting around, soaking it all in, reconnecting with people in our lives that we otherwise wouldn't have opportunities to talk to. And spend time with because of our travel. But the travel was and, you know, will continue to be fantastic because we've talked about this from in the past. The movie Back to the Future. Picture the scene where Michael J. Fox is in his mother, who's young, bedroom. And he's trying to, he puts the headphones on her and he's dressed in this, like, yellow suit. And he plays Van Halen. He's got these Nikes on. He comes from the future, right? We all come from the future when we go talk in other places, when we meet people in other places in this industry. You have this perspective, this pathway, this understanding that to us is just every day. It's intuitive. It's just what we've learned, what we experience, and we see the repeating patterns. But to people in other places around the world, especially Latin America, it's I don't know. It's eye-opening.
Yeah, and definitely for me, Bob, being Latino, speaking Portuguese, speaking Spanish, my mom being from Brazil, being a first-generation immigrant, you know, I got into this not because I love compliance. I got into this because I love social justice and what cannabis can really do for this planet. And I love the work you've done in so many other countries that have just sort of unlocked the potential, especially around hemp. We're talking sustainable housing. We're talking food. Talking fuel, we're talking what can really truly change and maybe save this planet from the path it's currently on. Not that hemp can vote yet, but that's a whole nother kind of story. But for me, it's really the passion going back to South America. When I lived there, I saw fights, war in the street every day between police and people in favelas. Where you every single day till today, since I lived there in Rio de Janeiro, you have 20 to 30 people dying in the streets over drugs. And a primary motivator of that, second largest consumed product is cannabis, is marijuana. So even though my policy experience has been heavily on the marijuana side, I'm loving this new synergy we get to see with hemp really almost taking a new step forward in terms of being able to provide a sustainable cash crop to places where social equity's never been considered in this war on drugs and cartels have held much of the power. So it's really, I think, a unique and blessed opportunity for us to be able to globe set globetrot, as Eric put it, and go around the world and start to talk from the future to people in the past still trying to wrap their heads around this. And especially in Latin culture, there's so much stigma and taboo against this. Mm-hmm. As soon as somebody hears the word marijuana, no matter what culture it is around the world, it means something. They have some preconceived notion around it. Mm-hmm. And in Latin America, that means traficante. It means carteles. It means murder and death. And marijuana has never killed anyone, neither has hemp. But the moment they hear that word, they're sort of thinking about it from that perspective. So being able to go to Panama and to Colombia and these places and being able to be on a team together and really truly get this message out there for people in a way that helps them open their minds from the past, right? We almost take this for granted in Colorado. It's like we had those conversations, what, 12 years, 13 years ago, right? And our grandmothers already know better. And for many places in the world, we're the messengers, kind of being able to bring that to people and get them to think about things a little bit differently.
Well, that's a gorgeous perspective and exactly what I wanted to really dive into here, which is that every culture around the world has some perspective on cannabis, whether that's in China, whether that's in South America, whether that's in Europe. And you guys, what's so interesting is you guys have gotten to go to those places as this has transitioned from a plant that was essentially illegal, or in the case of South America, as you say, it has all of these associations with an illegal industry and violence and crime, and not to mention when, you know, you're someone like myself whose only experience with it is the television show Narcos, but the United States government even funding and, you know, these elements, right? These elements.
Contras was created with crack by the CIA.
Exactly.
In urban communities to exactly. fund the entire, right, overthrow of governments in South America. This is just facts. The new war on drugs has been used to our government's political advantage. Absolutely.
Absolutely. And so the question is, as you have gone around the planet, as this has shifted from something that was in the night, from sprung from night into sun, and that's true in here in Colorado, it's true here in the United States, but it's true around the planet, as you have gone around the planet and tried to explain and characterize and bring life to this thing called the global cannabis industry, what are some of the things that have stood out to you or some of the cultural experiences that you've had on these intrepid pathways, if you will, that are just you never would have expected?
Well, again, the warm reception that you generally get, believe it or not, from government officials and from legislative bodies and when you go into places, there are, you know, more often than not, not just a welcome and shake a handshake and treated well, but folks generally tend to roll out not the literal red carpet, but they'll put out food and they'll have meals and they'll have plans for things to do together, and not just in Latin America, by the way, but certainly it's a little more heightened in Latin America. The hospitality, it's pretty good. So at the end of the day, some of the things that we've seen is, for example, when we were in Panama and Mark and I were there, and there was probably 50 people that were government officials from 20 or 30 different countries across the region and around the world in this room. And we were talking about compliance and regulatory choices, right? What are the regulatory choices you get to make? What agency is going to regulate the cultivation? What agency is going to regulate the production? Is it psychoactive? Is it non-psychoactive? Is it pharma? Is it over the counter? What is it? Their heads just start to spin. And you saw that in real time. And that Panama event sticks out to me because that was the one where there was it was an exclusive event. There was a number of high-level ranking officials in local Latin American governments. And every single one of them just looked up and said, like a deer in the headlights. And you know, but to set the table on this, of course, and we glossed over it at least in part, Mark himself has created iComply. iComply is an OG. Mark is an OG going back many, many years. In 08, 09, and I was going to say 13 years, but that's about right, and in Colorado, but then he's expanded across the country and around the world. So when you see people that see the opportunity, of course, have the connection to a particular region, like you talk about with Brazil and Latin America in general, it's how does that feel? How does that feel from working in a bunch of Broadway dispensaries in Denver to talking about this on a world stage?
Yeah, a lot of it was, you know, Colorado Springs and fourth most conservative place in the nation. So that's a loaded question, Bob. I mean, you know, being the young brown guy at that time trying to say, hey, caregivers shouldn't go to jail for providing patients with medicine and trying to keep guys like Bob Krause and other patients out of jail because we knew precedent law, right? Well, we knew precedent law was going to come down and change things in Colorado. That's how the opposition always tries to get you, right? So you're being involved in early industry associations, Amendment 64 for 3 years, running Southern Colorado, getting the fourth most conservative place to vote yes in favor of legalization by 10 votes. And it was real in the trenches sort of hard work. And, you know, to answer your question, I think it was challenging and still is. I didn't, you know, have massive investors coming at me going, hey, iComply is going to be the next greatest thing in weed. Like we see some of these tech companies raising $35 million out there or $10 million or whatever it is. No, that it was lint in my pocket and pursuing my passion. And from an OG perspective, absolutely. My parents thought I was crazy. My little Brazilian mom was like, Mark, what are you doing hanging out with all these druggies? You're going to ruin your life. And now today she grows hemp, you know, so it's been a hell of a transition. That's why I say it's a loaded question, and definitely worked on the caregiver bill, watching people go from the black market, right, to try to be gray, to being systemically cut out of being able to participate in this industry. It's a big reason that I, you know, volunteer my time with National Cannabis Industry Association and their Diversity, Equity, Inclusion Committee, as well as their policy council, to make sure that we have a voice moving forward to look at more models like Illinois and find out how we can include people. And at an international level, that's even more important to me because we're changing entire nations at a time, not just one state at a time. And if indigenous tribes can get back to growing a plant that isn't coca, right, and can actually make a difference for their people and people around the world as an exportable product, and they can produce an income and create new generational wealth for people that have been systemically oppressed by the war on drugs, I'm all about that.
So, all right, so here's the thing I'm thinking. You've got, in the United States, so much focus on some sort of social justice or social equity generally, but it is directly applicable to the cannabis industry for some of the reasons you just described, right? Now, we think about that from a U.S. perspective. There's the Last Prisoners Project, a great effort that we're supportive of. There's other projects that also seek to help people that have been incarcerated for cannabis offenses to be released from prison. My point, though, is that's what we think about in the United States. Now, put that into the Latin American context, where, as you articulated earlier, there's a sordid past. There's a history with, again, for whatever reason, I'm sure the U.S. drug policy has something to do with it. But let's talk about that. Let's talk about the social justice and that element, because Mexico is about to embark on legislation. And, you know, the stories, the fame, the infamy about what's happened, what happens recently in the news is in the front of a lot of people's minds. How do you make that change there? How do you deal with that kind of social justice in that scenario?
Definitely. And, you know, compared to the rest of Latin America, the United States is a baby country. We've had at least 250 years on every other country like Brazil or Puerto Rico, which is one of our territories, but the first place, right, that we started creating truly a Latin culture, and the Spanish had it for a long time. The Spanish-American War traded hands into the Americans' hands, and I worked there for 2 years as the government consultant to Puerto Rico, building their model out. So I got to sort of test case this ideology of Latin America versus sort of cannabis, but within a U.S. context and framework. And I think what's really interesting is that people don't realize sort of that gap in history makes a huge difference. And if anybody hasn't watched this yet, I really recommend going on Netflix, look up John Leguizamo's Latin History for Morons. It is a brilliant one-man show on Broadway that they put on Netflix, which will give you a little more context to this conversation. But to answer your question, it's the indigenous people that have suffered most, whether it's the Native Americans here, right, or even the Latinos, which are a mix of black, indigenous, and European, right? That word is so umbrella encompassing to so many subcultures. And Paraguay is different than Ecuador, is different than Brazil, than Colombia, than Venezuela, or Argentina, or Chile. And all of them are going to have a little bit of nuance, but we all share the same sort of past history that has developed to what it is today. And I think when you start implying this global connection of a global prohibition on drugs with everything we've done with Anslinger to the Convention of Narcotics and the way that that played out to schedules around the globe, Bob and I are very just busy trying to reverse that process to a large degree and roll that carpet back up, because it hasn't served anybody. And I think the people that suffer the most are the poorest people. And when we think of poverty here and just an inequality, it's not to discount from that, but just being an American is a privilege, no matter what the color of your skin, compared to a lot of other places. And I didn't realize what real poverty was until I lived in Latin America and saw, you know, what that actually looks like. People living in houses made of trash bags, or little kids that are naked on the street, you know, using their hands to mouth that they're hungry. It's not about sort of, can I bum a cigarette, or can I get a couple bucks for a drink or a beer or food, right? And not to, again, just unplay anything that's going on here, but that really opened my eyes. And I think that the people that are on these farms working for cents a day, dollars a day, we don't even contextualize that when we're asking for $15 an hour. Do you know what I mean? So I think that hemp, cannabis are one of the most amazing opportunities we have to get back to this sort of plant that has grown globally already, has been involved in so many tribes for thousands of years, so many places across the globe, because it's so human, right? And it's one of the only sort of things that supplement the endocannabinoid system, the biggest system in our bodies, et cetera. But it's also a huge opportunity to create generational wealth where it has been systemically stolen and robbed.
There's something that's so intangible about cannabis's re-emergence or reintroduction, and it really isn't a re-anything. As you say, it has been cultivated. There has been historical cultivation and usage around the planet. It doesn't matter where you're looking at. But what you bring to the table is the idea of a marketplace, an economy. You bring this aspect of business. And that is what is just so fascinating to see something. You know, the United States, at the end of the day, for right or wrong, and we can argue about it until the cows come home, but the United States has set the table for global trade, global commerce, all of the international bodies, the multinational organizations. The U.S. sits at the center and the heart of making those decisions. And to see this plant reemerge purely by really the efforts of people, by the people, which is what at the end of the day is supposed to be the governing force, even though it oftentimes feels like it is not the governing force, it is a success story. It is a win for the people. And as this plant comes back, and as everybody tries to fit it into whatever the situation in their country is, it brings me back to what Mark said at the very beginning, which is there's this wonderful synergy between the marijuana side, the psychoactive side, and the hemp side, the non-psychoactive side. And I just...
The yin and the yang?
The yin and the yang, man. And what I'm interested in is, you know, when countries look at this, and we've been working with some Latin American countries to try to figure out how hemp and how cannabis is going to start to play a role in their economy. We look at that individual country. We say, okay, what are the existing agricultural industries that already exist here? What infrastructure already exists as it relates to international trade, processing, import, export, et cetera? The core competencies. And so what the question is, I don't know. That's not my job. My job is just to stand here and give some fodder.
I think the question is, Bob, how do you best understand that and leverage that for the best success you can get out of every country you go to? Because you've, what, 20, over 20 countries at this point that you've helped out in writing some level of their legislation or their laws to create a new possibility that wasn't there before.
Exactly. So here's the deal. What model works best? There's a debate about that. The United States, let's face it, we never like to face issues legislatively or from a policy perspective directly. So we always like to just sort of backdoor things, react. And the way the United States has reacted as it relates to cannabis policy at both the state and federal level and a hemp level is by doing things that don't directly address the issue, but prevent the government from actually taking action. For example, in the marijuana industry, and I have to say marijuana because that's the legal terminology we're talking about right now. In fact, marijuana with an H, okay? So at the end of the day, the marijuana plant is 100% without question illegal under federal law. The federal government knows this. States have enacted robust regulatory programs to operate in the cannabis space, both medical and adult use. Federal government's aware of this. So what is the solution? If you and I were to sit down over a beer, we might say, well, the solution should be states are doing it. We should legalize the thing and maybe even defer to their regulation. Instead, what we have is, no, let's not do that. Instead, let's create a spending prohibition so that it can remain illegal, but the government can't do anything about it. Okay? And why? It's very American. It's very American. And I think it's fantastically American, to be honest with you. Other countries, why they move more slowly on public policy, particularly in this space, is because they truly want to deliberate and solve the problem. It doesn't mean they've all solved it. Doesn't mean they've solved it well, but they move slowly and methodically. And this is not, you know, look how the other countries have done it. The U.S. didn't do it as well. The U.S. sort of has its head in the sand on this issue, but with sort of one eye out of the sand, watching what's happening on one hand and saying, no, I'm not seeing that on the other hand. So that's what the marijuana policy has evolved to. Now, I'd say the same thing in part about industrial hemp. Industrial hemp has a rich history in this country, particularly in red states like Kentucky. And where did the most sweeping, this is a trivia question, by the way, where did the most sweeping cannabis reform policy in U.S. history, which United States political party did that come from?
Republicans.
The Republicans, Mitch McConnell, because of that Kentucky connection. And in Colorado, we enacted, prior to the 2014 Farm Bill, we enacted hemp legislation and hemp regulations under the guise that hemp was different than marijuana. And it is, with the promise of agriculture and all these 50,000 uses. And we're getting there slowly but surely. But at the end of the day, what happens is you're still saying, look at this hemp plant for all of these industrial uses it can provide, which it will, and it certainly does, but it will on a grander scale. In the meanwhile, saying, but we really just want to sell CBD and cannabinoids. That's okay. Now, I kind of want to just twist this for a minute, and you can add your comments into it, because I wanted to bring up with you something that you and I talked about, which is related. It's a public policy thing. Farm Bill, U.S. Law on hemp. U.S. Farm Bill comes out in 2018. President Trump signs it around December 18th of 2018. The thing that you looked at was it did all these different things. And I tried, or at least my lawyers and I tried to define those things so that we could say this new farm bill does these things. One of those things was, as it turns out back then, a controversial topic. Hemp and all of its derivatives are no longer controlled substances under the Controlled Substances Act. Which means THC. And I think I said one time, like with a smirk on, as I tend to do periodically, THC from hemp is no longer a controlled substance either. And you said, well, that's a dangerous, that's a slippery slope. Now, and this is certainly a compound question. Here we go today, hemp companies all over the country pushing the envelope a little bit. THC, THCV, THCA. I always say this. 1 acre of hemp produces 9 to 12 metric tons of biomass. If 0.3% of that is THC,
yeah.
Would you say that's a shitload?
That's a lot. And people that are eating CBD probably know this. I own Integrity Farms, got the trademark. I'm definitely a client of yours, Bob. And we sell smokable hemp products, and they are 0.3%. I can't control how much people smoke my product, right? So if they... yeah, smoke 10 joints of that. Are they going to get a buzz? Potentially. And you're not wrong. And I don't think we lead with, hey, all THC from hemp derived.
Correct.
Right, because it's just not the political message. I do want to circle back, though, to previously just talking about the core competencies of countries. Mm-hmm. Because it's such one of those things that I really admire and respect about working with you. And I heard this when we were on the Panama stage. And by the way, one of the other things I really appreciate is that you invited me to share your time on the Panama stage. Talk about social equity in action, not just talk. And that meant the world to me. So thank you for just appreciating me to be there with you and share your time. I don't know that anybody else is like, yeah, come share my speaking time with me. You're awesome. But having said that, to go back to sort of the core company's question, I love the fact that you sit down with government officials and go, let's do a 90-minute questionnaire. because most of the time they don't even know their own policy objectives. And a big conversation is, what are we good at and what do we love to do already as a country and as a culture? And if you're into coca production in Colombia, yeah, you might be good at hemp production and there's something there to be transformed because you're having these types of conversations. So I just wanted to conclude on that. And I'll go back to just the issue of being a hemp farmer and now I can be criminalized at 0.5. There's a whole different kind of conversation going on with the farm bill and with what the USDA regulation might look like for small farmers. And most of them are. We grow over 50% of the hemp here in Colorado for the U.S. And out of that, I would say that 80% of what I run across has been grown hot, meaning it's over 0.3. It's 0.31. It is marijuana by definition.
Delta 9 or total plant?
Well, exactly. And according to the USDA...
homogenized or flower only?
Correct. And according to the FDA and their new proposed regulations, total, which isn't the case, right? But even though when you decarboxylate it and smoke it, it's going to be that amount of THC, right? Delta 9. So it's one of those huge areas that I just love the fact that you guys are in communication with them about it and looking at this issue, because for a lot of farmers out there, you know, this year was very different than last year. This year I'm getting calls from seed companies left and right going, hey, we have a bunch of clones and we need to sell it, and we have a bunch of seeds, we need to sell it. And it seems like less farmers are going into the business. I don't know if that's a cause of COVID or if that's a cause of this uncertainty kind of coming down with the USDA regs or some combination of the two, I imagine. But it is an interesting problem that we face here that globally, right, you guys are just writing better and smarter laws at 1% or at 0.5%. Right. So I would love to hear a little bit more about sort of how that impacts your world and why, I guess I get why you're doing that in other countries, but how other countries are receiving that.
Well, you know, it really comes down to what's the market opportunity. And you talked before about farmers planting less in the U.S., but in other countries, farmers wanting to plant more. But we have to educate because we have to make sure that the same problem didn't happen, which led to the decrease in acreage in the United States in 2020, and that is COVID, certainly, because don't forget that came before planting season, but also the fact that there's, you know, bales of biomass unsold. There's crude, buckets and buckets and buckets of it. There's 4 million pounds that I'm aware of right now of unextracted biomass sitting in a warehouse in Kentucky that I have to deal with tomorrow. My point to you is that there is a lot of material that was not processed. So that hopefully causes us as industry operators, but also these government officials, to get a little reality dose. Ain't nobody going to get rich on this stuff right now. When it was a limited market, sure, there were opportunities. But right now, it's governments need to create an agricultural-based industry which produces cannabinoids, but also encourages and promotes the production of other materials from the plant.
What I love too, Bob, is that you've always been about the industrial plant because you can get full use out of it. Even a 4% CBD yield might make sense when we have a CBD glut, right? Frankly put, plus the seeds, plus the fiber. One of the biggest challenges you and I are trying to co-tackle right now is the problem with actually being able to process true industrial hemp. Decortification, right? We're up against competitors like China, like India across the globe. And in that process, we can't produce at the price they can, but maybe we can produce at the quality needed for BMW to produce car parts, right? And we need here in the Americas true commercial size level processing, and then to get farmers encouraged around producing industrial instead of CBD Christmas tree plants, right? So what are your thoughts on that? I mean, how do you think we can achieve that here in America? I'm looking at places in Mexico with indigenous tribes who have the money, who have the land. And like you said, Mexico's transforming right now. How do we present even projects like that to the government or get really the multinationals, the people with money, because these aren't cheap processing plants, to make it go forward? Because we need really affordable raw materials before you can use any of the purposes of hemp, well, right? It's 25,000 uses.
No. And Mark, that is... We will do this again very soon. I think that we are talking about so many different topics that we could go on for hours.
Well, and I have a thought on this.
You do.
I have a thought on this, and it's not the answer to all of your business problems, but it is, if you are a listener of this podcast, if you are somebody who cares about the Hoban Minute and you care about the cannabis plant, please, the next time you're at the grocery store, buy some hemp seed. The next time you need some piece of clothing, go and buy a hemp piece of clothing. Until we prove to the real business decision makers out there that there is a demand from the consumer side for hemp products, it's going to be difficult to raise the capital necessary to create this kind of processing. And I believe at the end of the day that there are people who care about the story of where their things are made. What does that mean? Yes, hemp textiles are produced for very cheap in China. However, if we can produce that same hemp textile in Kentucky, and it goes from Kentucky to California, where it then gets cut and dyed and turned into a beautiful t-shirt that you get to wear around, think about all of the costs that aren't necessarily attached on that price tag, but that are mitigated. What do I mean by that? When you go to Walmart and you buy a $5 t-shirt, you have to think about the material that was used to produce that fabric and that t-shirt was moved all around this globe just so that you could go and buy it at Walmart for a couple dollars. We have to prove the demand. We have to show the people who really have the money, who really have the decision-making power, that people care about this. Go and support hemp businesses. Buy a CBD product. If you don't like it, who the heck cares? But just put your money where your mouth is and let's show them that the demand is there. That's going to mobilize the capital necessary to move this thing forward. And really, whether that's here in the U.S. or anywhere around the world, buy hemp. Buy hemp, man.
Well, not to get into this too deeply, but Eric, listen. Hemp stands for, based on market studies from clients of this law firm, it stands for the proposition of nature, of natural, of organic. Whether it is technically quote-unquote organic or not is besides the point. At the end of the day, that's what hemp stands for. And because that's what it stands for, there's an opportunity there. But we've talked about this. I've written about this. Does hemp want to exist as its own industry where you have to get people to say, I love hemp, which if they did, their lives would be better. I can attest to that. But that's not what people necessarily are going to do. It goes to the article that we wrote, and we put it out in Forbes, and it says, basically, is hemp its own industry, or does it need to attach to other industries? It needs to integrate.
It needs to integrate. Because the reality is numbers and dollars and cents. These are practical capitalists out there that are going to demand hemp. It's not like BMW isn't already producing cars and not promoting to consumers that their cars are made of hemp. All they're looking for is that manufacturer in Mexico to be like, here's your dashboard made out of hemp, without having to promote that it's made out of hemp. So you don't have to love hemp for hemp to show up in all your products when the cost of raw materials becomes sufficiently low enough that people will adopt it over other plastics, worse products. Then that marginal cost, marginal benefit becomes a much easier conversation to the water bottle producer, right? To the person that's putting plastic out there all day long out of oil and all these other places, when hemp could do the same job. And then it's not actually about promoting and marketing hemp anymore. It's at that point just a sustainable product that has reached a price point because we've done our job, Bob and I, to put this in place. And processing facilities are the key difference to producing enough raw materials out of hemp that you can make all of those products necessary.
Well, Eric, again, another topic we could talk about for quite literally hours, but at the end of the day, it's about the pricing. As Mark points out, this will be my last thought on this topic, is if I want to buy some form of grain to put into a smoothie, into yogurt, to be an additive in a store, I'm looking at cents per pound of large units of chia seed, of other types of protein-packed seeds and grain that I'd put into my foods. When I'm talking about industrial hemp, in the aggregate, for high-quality seeds, for high-quality grain, I'm looking at a lot higher pricing. It's because of the quantity. It's because of the adoption. And until the pricing becomes equivalent, we can't get to the point where we're simply talking about apples and apples between you know, hemp seeds and other forms of grain that are available for protein additives and so forth and so on. And that's really the key. So sustainable farming based on true agricultural principles that use the entire plant, the green buffalo, for heaven's sakes, Eric, use the whole plant. If we do that, then all of a sudden we've got an industry and that industry can thrive. But what is that industry? It's hemp being utilized in multiple other industries. I stand by that. I believe that. And that's not a negative thing. That's not to the detriment of industrial hemp.
The benefit of those other industries.
It's the benefit of the other industries. And it's to the respect and to the proper placement of industrial hemp. Because, once again, I'm not saying that hemp is going to save the world. But it's the only thing that can.
And let the record reflect that Mark did say that hemp may be the only thing that can save the world.
It's definitely part of the solution. We can't talk about global warming and all the catastrophes that are going to come to this planet if we continue on the same path of unconscious capitalism, let's say, and expect it to make a difference. And hemp has to be. I mean, it's part of the solution. I'm not saying it's the only solution. There's a lot of other great innovative technologies. We have a lot of consciousness working on this, right, globally, planet-wise. And as we go to these other countries, people are pretty tuned into the fact that we only got one rainforest. We only got one Amazon. We only got one set of rivers and fresh water. We only have certain amounts of limited resources, and our population keeps going up, right? Not down. So you can only fit so many cows on an acre. The whole conversation is just really brutally true. No, we don't maybe want to think about it. Perhaps coronavirus has put it into a different perspective for a little bit so we can talk about it. And I think, you know, to Bob's point, the raw materials becoming cost effective is the point of integration. And the only way we can do that is not by shipping it in from India and China, where they're mass producers of hemp, but a low grade quality that BMW won't pick them up because it's not good enough specification, or SpaceX won't pick them up because you can't put astronauts' lives at risk with a hemp shield that's not up to spec. So if we have the right types of processing facilities over a biodegradable material, over a sustainable material like hemp, especially in things like plastic. Plastics, look around you right now as a listener. Take 2 seconds to do that. And just think about what around you could be made out of hemp. I mean, yeah, it's not about promoting the hemp at that point. It's about getting it to a cost-effective standpoint. And the true solution doesn't look like one of these in North America, Central America, and South America, like Bob and I are trying to work on right now. That's the pioneering to hundreds of these in every continent. And enough farmers that can be able to produce. Because what other material in the world do you know of that naturally comes from the earth that can do so many things? So many things. And we're starting to see the demand for specificity and quality standard already in CBD. You cannot sell, export, import without some level of GMP standardization, ISO standardization, because they have to make sure that it's plus or minus within a certain variance, that product's going to be consistently produced the same way. And there's not going to be a difference when it comes to hemp bioplastic composites, or when it comes to decortification and the type of herd that you get out of an industrial plant. So these are the types of conversations that we're really wrapping our heads around now. And finding the right multinationals out there to see that vision and see that future, I think is going to be the real game changer.
If you made it to minute 37 or 38 of this podcast, know that you are along for the journey of the Hoba Minute, because this has been by far just one of the most fun, engaging, and really delving into the aspects of all of these topics that are kind of on the fringe. They're on the cutting edge. They are really what's going to move all of this forward. And we thank you, our listeners, for tuning in. We thank Mark for being here and joining us on the Hoba Minute and taking us on a journey that is truly where we need to go. And Bob, as always, man, it's a pleasure. It's an honor. And what more is there to say?
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Hoban Minute. Do you have any ideas for episode topics or guests? We would like to hear from you. Reach out to us at media@hoban.law and stay tuned for more on the Hoban Minute.